My name's Aditi.
And I'm Aiden.
And this is Banterly, the new podcast by Immigrantly, hosted by us, two Gen Z co-hosts.
Every week, we'll cover a set of TV shows or movies that all follow a particular theme. We'll be talking about sex, baby.
And also race.
Gender.
Representation in media, or the lack of representation.
We'll, of course, be talking about Miss Taylor Swift.
Ice Spice.
What's trending on the TikTok.
And we'll give our hot takes while unpacking the exciting and problematic elements of pop culture.
It's TV, it's movie, it's that celebrity gossip that's been going on. It's everything that a lot of our generation likes to hear about. And so it's just a space to have discussions that connect those fun things to like real world issues and cultural commentary on how our generation eats, sleeps, breathes, drinks, and
dare I say banters?
I like what you did there. Weaving it in. I like that.
A little something we'll do here on Banterly. Join us every Wednesday for pop culture takes, media critiques, and ultimately, and also most importantly, banter.
Banterly. Available wherever you get your podcasts starting January 10th.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. If you are a regular listener, you might recall our recent episode on DEI titled Diversity Hire, Claudine Gay and the Future of DEI. If you haven't had the chance to tune in yet, I highly recommend listening to it. You won't be disappointed. Today, I delve deeper into diversity, equity and inclusion with a remarkable guest who is making waves in this space. But before I introduce her, let's take a moment to reflect. You know, it's disheartening to witness institutions like the University of Florida and major corporations like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan scaling back their DEI efforts due to political pressures. Are we allowing divisive rhetoric to overshadow the importance of creating inclusive environments where everyone feels valued? Diversity, equity, and inclusion are not just buzzwords, right? They represent fundamental principles vital for fostering a society where everyone feels respected and included, regardless of background. And I don't care what your political affiliation is, as long as you advocate for creating safe and inclusive spaces for all. I am really excited that our today's guest, Netta Jenkins, embodies the spirit of challenging norms and advocating for change. Raised by immigrant parents from Liberia, Netta grew up in Rhode Island. She's been a fierce advocate for inclusivity from a young age. With a wealth of experience in corporate leadership and a burning passion for disrupting the status quo, Netta founded Aerodie, a consulting firm dedicated to helping companies elevate their DEI initiatives. I am so excited to sit down with her and talk about the world of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So let's get started. Hello, hello. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. I like the yellow shirt on you. It looks really good.
I wanted to bring some sunshine today.
You did. I mean, New York is cloudy, so I like sunshine. I want sunshine.
I hear that.
How have you been?
I've been good. Have been busy, and I'm sure you know very well, leading an organization is not the easiest thing, right? You're always in meetings and you're always thinking of ways about ways to scale and really push the needle forward. So that's kind of the phase I'm in right now. But overall, I'm doing really well. I love that there's some sun outside. I love that I have a chance to speak with you on such an important topic. So excited to be here.
And I don't know how you do it. I am so impressed with you. I want to be Netta when I grow up.
Well, I want to be you when I grow up. So we need a swap soon.
When I first spoke to you a few weeks back, I was just enamored by your infectious energy. And I can see that shine through right now.
Thank you.
How do you keep yourself motivated and stay positive?
I think what really keeps me grounded is, one, getting sleep. I had to realize the importance of sleep. It's, again, kind of going back to the CEO, the founder life. It's very easy to think, oh, I'm okay. And oh, let me continue working. And then your body just starts to deteriorate. I think also prayer, and I pray a lot throughout the day. And there was someone, I forget the person's name, that had said what they do is they give themselves at least 5 to 6 no's per day. So that means if you're working on a project or let's say you're working on increasing sales for your organization and you're pitching away, you're pitching what you have, and all you hear from maybe the customers or the clients that you're working with potentially is no, no, no. We're not interested at this time. It's okay. And so I've been giving myself that permission as well. It's, hey, I get at least 5 to 6 no's. When I heard that in an interview that this person did, I was so intrigued by it. And I do that now. And that has kept me grounded because I'm like, oh, only 3 no's today? I have like 2 or 3 more no's that I need. I did a really good job.
Oh my gosh. I can see how that would reorient someone to see their success or failure.
It shifts your mindset. It really shifts your mindset because now it's okay. You know, it's okay if you receive those no's. And guess what? You're going to receive a yes. And that yes may be the only yes that you need to take you to the next level.
Yeah, Netta, but I feel like with women of color, especially for us, that yes doesn't come often.
Sure doesn't.
We have to fight, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 times harder to get to that yes, because there are so many roadblocks and there are so many no's before we get to that one yes. And I really want to give a shout out to all those mentors who have given us the gift of yes.
Yeah.
Because it is so important, right? We don't talk about it as much. And you've had those mentors in your life as well.
Yeah, definitely. I've had incredible mentors. But going back to what you were saying, the overproving, the overdoing becomes overwhelming. And that's how come I find so much grace in taking the time to rest, but also leaning on others that are experiencing the same thing that I'm experiencing, that can say, oh my goodness, had the same experience. And maybe someone else didn't have that experience, right? But that really helps me to get through. And I think those sponsors, those mentors that may not experience the barriers, but they see them, they understand them. And because of that, they amplify the work that you do in rooms that you are not in. Like that is the most powerful thing that one can do. And that's when doors really begin to open.
Absolutely. Netta, I want to go back to your childhood. Now, you are a kid of immigrants. Your parents moved from Liberia in the 80s.
Yes.
And your childhood was spent in Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about those years. What memories stand out?
I remember the early days of beautiful memories of not really understanding how identity works. Just thinking, oh, I'm just a little girl riding my bike around, searching for dinosaur fossils with my friend James. I used to ride a bike like it was a car. That was like my life. I'm like, oh my God, I got to ride this with one hand, right? Until I fell all the way down the hill. But yeah, I was the type of child that was always asking questions and wanted to search and wanted to innovate at a very young age, hence why I was searching for dinosaur fossils, because I thought I would be the one to find it. But then there was a pivotal moment that had me realize at a very young age, at the age of 7 years old, that, goodness, I'm Black. You know, I'm Black and my family's Black and I'm African and my family has an accent. And oh, wow, by the way, my family's not from this country. I saw the inequities and the treatment at a young age, and specifically at age 7, a white identifying woman had walked in to my yard and she proclaimed, she said, Blacks don't belong in my neighborhood. And I was predominantly in a white neighborhood. And then she proceeded to spit in my mother's face. And I watched as a 7-year-old, the phlegm dripped down my mom's cheek. So it's one thing, one, spitting in someone's face is like the most disrespectful thing ever, right? But it's one thing to have kind of that soft spit, but then to see phlegm, like the pure evil, wickedness, racism. I can't even describe the word and the feeling that I had at the age of 7, but I do remember as if it was yesterday, the way in which my mom felt, because I felt all of her energy in that moment. I felt her thinking, do I react? Y'all know the way one may want to react if you spit in someone's face, right, as a human being, or do I walk away? And the reason why one would even walk away is because you're thinking about, well, would they believe me, right? Like if cops came, like, would they believe me? No, she's the one who started it. She actually spit in front of my face, in front of my daughter, and she said, Blacks don't belong in this neighborhood, and she's on my property. I felt all of this energy for my mom, and the decision that my mom made was to hold my hand, turn us around, and we walked back into that house, and we never really unpacked it when I was younger. And I remember going into my room, and that's when I vowed, I mean, I cried. I cried to my core at a very young age, and I vowed to never be silent again. And really, that's when this work around really advocating for those that are voiceless due to the inequities and the racist views that people have really took it to a next level for me.
First, Netta, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. But there are a lot of those white women still. Mm-hmm. They exist in neighborhoods, in cities. We see them, which is so unfortunate, right? Mm. But I'm curious, your mom being an immigrant, for her, probably this was a much bigger shock because she probably did not even understand as much the racial dynamics that exist within the U.S. Racial hierarchy that exists within the U.S. is so specific to the United States itself. People coming from outside the U.S., from Africa, South Asia, wherever, for them, it's a shocking revelation.
Oh, it's extremely shocking. Extremely shocking. I mean, you know, she's from Liberia and she was around folks that had identified as her. She was also around white identifying people as well in different cultures because they're in Africa too. My mom even has a son that's half Lebanese. So like then coming to this country where you think it's land of the free.
Is it?
It, or that perception, right? That perception for some folks that may be in other countries and thinking, and especially years ago, thinking, okay, well, yeah, I hear about the opportunities and the excitement around that. You're not thinking, okay, I'm going to have the biggest racial experiences of my life. I'm going to have the biggest barriers, even landing opportunities just due to my skin color. Or I'm going to have the biggest barriers even getting an increase at my job that I've worked for years because of my accent. You know, those are things that my mom went through. And I'm so happy she brought me in this world along with the Lord, right? Because I was able at a young age to also advocate for her and speak on her behalf. But that's hard. It's another layer in complexity when you even have an accent.
I have an accent and sometimes I'm surprised by how big a deal it is for other people. Mm-hmm. English, it was always a second language for us because I grew up in Pakistan, which was a British colony at one point in time.
Yeah.
I was never conscious about my accent, but I see so many people being judged for it, discriminated, and it takes a huge toll on individuals who are subjected to that kind of discrimination, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And as you said, it's an added layer. Netta, have you ever had these difficult conversations with your mom about accent, about race, discrimination?
Yeah.
How does that conversation even happen? Where do we even start?
It really happens. And I think, you know, going back, having immigrant, having African parents, they're not always going to sit down and say, yeah, let's have this conversation.
I know.
You're kind of on your own, right? It's not like the American norm of we're all going to eat dinner at the family table and now unpack your feelings. It's like,
yes, we don't do that. We don't do that.
We just don't do that, right? Like not as emotional. So it really almost came out of like an element of, oh my goodness, I'm in this situation. So it was my mom sharing with me, you know, she had worked in the hospital for many years. And then someone that was working there for maybe, gosh, maybe just like a couple months, really drew close to her and really, really liked her as a human being. And he was a white man. And he was like, Nelly, you have been here for years at this organization. You should definitely, you know, get more money, because my mom had disclosed to him how much she was making. And so she was advocating for herself, but he actually told her, like, here's how much they started me off with, and I don't even have nearly as much as the experience. See, it goes back to like, that is what I call an individual being an actionist. Because in the moment, he didn't say, oh, I feel so bad. Yeah, you should go and advocate for yourself. He said, no, here's how much I'm making. Here's what you need to say to them, because this is an issue.
Oh, it is an issue.
Trust me, it became an issue. So when she told me, I said, oh, all right, here's what we're going to do. We can easily take legal action.
How old were you, Netta, at the time?
It was like a few years ago. And she's been working in this country for years. What they were paying her was so low, you know? And I think, again, it's, she's a Black woman. She's an immigrant. You know, it's oh, well, we know this woman's going to work hard. We'll just continue paying her what we're going to pay her. Meanwhile, we just brought this person on board. He's been here for just a few months, nearly has as much experience, works as hard as she does. And he even said that. And he had significantly more.
I'm not surprised.
And so like those are the moments that were really sacred in having these conversations. And even when I was younger, you know, we didn't unpack immediately when I was 7 years old with that incident. But as I started to experience more issues, so going to a predominantly white school, being called a monkey, and all of these terms, I would go back to my mom and she said, wait, what? And that's when we had the opportunity to really unpack it. And she would always say, Netta, no matter what someone says to you or calls you, please always know who you are. Always know who you came from, where you are, where you want to go. She said, because those people won't even be nothing. And when I tell you, the people that even said those comments, ugh, gosh, I don't even know where they are in life, but they're not doing too well, you know? And so it's really, really interesting to see, but I'm happy that there were those moments that we could unpack, but it wasn't because it was, hey, we're setting this time to unpack it. It was almost like, oh my gosh, I'm in a dire need right now. I'm experiencing this.
And it was probably more organic, right?
It was definitely organic.
It's 2011 and the Arab Spring is raging. A lesbian activist in Syria starts a blog. She names it Gay Girl in Damascus.
Am I crazy? Maybe.
As her profile grows, so does the danger.
The object of the email was, please read this while sitting down.
It's like a genie came out of the bottle and you can't put it back.
Gay Girl Gone. Available now.
Let us fast forward to now. You are a leader in DEI space. How would you explain DEI to someone who's never heard of it before?
On a basic scale, when I ask leaders, what is DEI? They never know. They say diversity recruiting. I say, Do you want everyone within your organization to have an opportunity to excel in advance? Of course, Netta. Yes, we do. Okay. Well, if you do, then we have to do the due diligence in identifying who's not advancing and why. And so when I break it down in that way, it becomes very clear for many folks that are still trying to understand what this work is all about, is how do we break it down? And even if we started off at a high level of which departments within the organization are performing well and which ones aren't. So the ones that aren't, let's dive a little bit deeper. Who are those leaders within the organization or within that department? Who are the members on their team, right? If a department isn't doing well, then the folks in that on that end of the stick are probably not advancing. So what's the hindrance and what's the roadblock? And those are the things that we start to unpack, those barriers that exist.
So what are some of the roadblocks?
Some of those roadblocks can be more process related. So a specific example could be if an engineering team is trying to hire, they need to hire someone because there's a process gap on their team. Immediately that engineering manager is going to say, well, I needed someone yesterday. So they're going to start identifying people that they know, right? That's what any human would do. And immediately what happens is, one, you don't take a look at the people who are already on your team to advance them. But two, now you're bringing in someone that not only looks like you, but has the same experience, same mindset. And so you're not really implementing the diversity, even within the process and the approach of advancement, right? So that's one. There's another of conformity. A lot of people then are suppressed and having to conform because they are the only. Maybe it's, hey, well, you know, we're going to add representation, but just one person.
This is such a good point, Netta. What does representation in workplace really mean?
So when folks say representation, it's really kind of targeting those that are from marginalized groups, right? Like those that have been really voiceless within organizations. And it can be on an intersectional lens. So those are women, Black identifying people, Asian identifying people, Middle Eastern identifying people, right? If we break it down into intersectionality, it's, are those people caregivers? Are they veterans? Are they part of the LGBTQIA plus community? So it's really kind of identifying within an organization, who are those folks that are underrepresented that have not had a seat at the table and even a voice at the table?
I want to stop you here, Netta, and expand on this a bit. Theoretically, yes, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. But practically, at least what I've heard and the research that I've seen, white women are the biggest recipients of this process.
Absolutely. And so representation definitely includes white women as well.
But I feel like they are at the top of organizational hierarchy when it comes to recruitment, right?
Absolutely.
So then to me, representation is not really representation.
I think it goes back to the organization really identifying who is truly underrepresented within their organization. I think a lot of organizations take the easy way out and they say, okay, well, all women, and yes, there's underrepresentation of all women at senior levels. That's just a fact. But when we look at it and we see, okay, well, the only representation that has truly increased at senior levels are predominantly white women, then we have to start to break down and say, well, are we only looking at a specific population of women?
Right.
And is that specific population of women only white women? Does it not include other identities? I think the other piece too is organizations are still stuck on utilizing tools that are so old school. It gives you male or female. It gives you women, and it buckets everyone in just one box. When women as a whole, we have different, we're not a monolith, essentially.
We are not. Absolutely.
We're not a monolith. The experience that a white woman will have within an organization will be vastly different from the experience a Hispanic or Latina woman would have, or a Black woman would have, or an Asian identifying woman would have, or a Middle Eastern woman would have. I even had a close friend who's Middle Eastern identifying say to me, Netta, I don't identify as white, but that's the only box that I can check. So what happens is that she's being grouped in a population she doesn't identify with. The organization will never be able to serve her and her needs. And we see that across the board as it pertains to representation. So yeah, you absolutely brought up a great point.
But then you created this platform to make everything equitable.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how did you create it and how is it different from all the other tools that are used to measure the efficacy of inclusivity programs and strategies?
You know, I built this tool really out of frustration. As VP of Global Inclusion within various corporations, I was just so tired of always presenting the business case. I was so tired of seeing the inequities even within resources amongst departments. You see what the marketing department gets for a budget, finance department, everyone gets a budget. And then the DEI budget is low, but you're supposed to create all this grand impact. How do you do that without resources? Like, you know, the inequity in that, right? And the population that serves typically within that role as well. And so there were a variety of frustrations, and I had to really take a look at my audience. There's three pockets essentially that I serve. One, I had to think about executive leadership, senior leadership. Senior leaders want to understand what's the business impact. They've read the reports, they've read the research, right?
So it's all about the bottom line.
It's all about the bottom line. And so there is that population. I had to think about how can I show them the business impact in real time. So they're engaged in this almost every single day.
That's genius, Neda. You're speaking their language, basically.
Well, that's what we have to do. You know, we have to speak to different audiences. Once I really grasped onto that, that's when like really ignited the product ideation of what I have today. The second audience is those are your ERGs. Those are your chief people officers, your chief diversity officers. They love this work. They're passionate about this work. They want to see and they demand the change, right? So it's how do we serve that population? How do we get them ignited? And it's for them to see, even through light impacts of their efforts, how they are driving change and how it's being poured right back into them, how the organization's being poured right back into them. And then the third bucket are people just that don't give a damn. You know, it's like, I don't want to do this. I don't need to do this. I have inheritance, right? I'm fine. DEI must die. Like it's all of these.
Oh my gosh, we have to talk about DEI must die slogan. It's taking over.
It's taking over. And so that population, and I'm serving them too.
How do you serve them? How do you reason with them?
Yeah. Well, I don't reason with them, right? And I'm not trying to, and I'm also not, I'm not even trying to change their mindset. It's okay. But what I know from behavioral psychology, which is my background, is the more someone does something and takes action on something, the more they start like wanting to know a little bit more. And so the way that I get that population is through the gamification element. It's, oh, I want to get my points today. So now you want to get your points today, but in order to actually even gain your points, you're taking inclusive actions.
That's so incredible.
And so what I always say is middle managers, the managers that have about 5 to 10 direct reports, they are the real inclusion leaders. They have the opportunity to attract talent, retain talent, or make a talent run away, And if they are a true inclusion leader, then they have to be inspired and motivated. And they can be in either three of those buckets. But let's say they're in the bucket that just doesn't give a damn. Now they can actually see, wow, through these fun things, right? The fun, engaging elements, I'm actually driving impact. Oh my gosh, I saved my team. I'm retaining my team because now they start to see their own impact. It's a psychological behavior shift that takes place.
Neda, what is your platform called? It's AeroDie, right?
AeroDie, yes.
What are the AI components of AeroDie?
So the AI components that we're building in right now are really the trend components is for an organization to see out of all of the outcomes and some of those goals implemented in the platform, what are the top trends of the outcomes? So now as an organization, they can see, wow, here is what we've actually really drove impact on. We've been able to increase a new customer acquisition because it's linked to the inclusion efforts that we're tackling from this goal. We have been able to see greater success in RFP wins, and it's linked to that. We have been able to see greater brand equity, right? And because of that, we're able to attract talent, or we're able to see retention levels. So everything is really linked, but it's able to really kind of show them the overall trend of their outcomes. And that's what we're utilizing AI for.
How big a company or an org should be in order for them to be able to implement your platform? Is there a specific size? Is there a minimum threshold?
So I'm in the enterprise SaaS space. So we're working with Fortune 500 organizations. We're also working with mid-size, and we've even started to connect with smaller organizations that have like 500 to 1,000. So I will say this is industry agnostic and very open to the amount of employees that an organization has.
But obviously there have been critics of DEI, right? Largely conservative political voices. It is so sad to see that our political divide is so deep that we are denying humanity to folks, right? If DEI is not implemented, and we see different organizations, institutions slashing DEI programs, I read somewhere Goldman Sachs has slashed DEI programs, JP Morgan is doing that. What might be the consequences?
There are already lawsuits coming out. I just read an article. I think there's a class action suit against Tesla with 6,000 Black identifying employees and the discrimination that they face. Like, we will see so many organizations going through legal battles that they will be losing left and right. We'll see an eruption happen. I will say that there's always room to improve in this space and in this work. For a very long time, the gap for me with DEI has been, it hasn't quite been able to show the business impact. And I get it as someone that's leading an organization. As a leader of an organization, you want to see what that business impact brings. We read about it in the reports, but there hasn't truly been a tool that shows leaders, okay, this is how it works. A lot of these organizations are relying on their diversity reports. And that's not going to do anything. Even with the diversity reports, even if there's a slight uptick, people are still suffering. We see that people are even hurting themselves or dying by suicide.
But Neda, isn't it sad that we have to make a business case for something that should be the norm, that should come to us naturally and organically, even if these different institutions and workplaces were to reflect the actual population makeup of the US? They don't.
Well, the thing about it is many of these organizations don't care because the leaders that are at the top don't identify as those from underrepresented groups. So then you don't understand the barriers. You don't understand the barriers. And that's how come I say it does go back to the business impact. I don't think it's having to prove this business case over and over, but we're in a capitalistic world at the end of the day. So I never want to be naive to that. Many leaders are still going to want to see, okay, what's the correlation here? There can't continue to be tactics data. And I mean by, hey, there's been an ERG uptick in participation. Okay. Great. What does that mean? What does that even mean for the people in these groups? For me, I want to see if there are ERGs within an organization, then how are people advancing to the next level? If those people within that ERG that's fighting to advance the organization are not the ones advancing in the organization, then what does it prove? Just to say, okay, there's an ERG and we support these people, because essentially what they become are segregated groups that don't have the support to actually flourish. I mean, oftentimes what we find is there aren't even executives that are involved.
Neda, for those who may not know what ERG is, can you explain that?
So an ERG is essentially just an employee resource group. It's where folks from underrepresented groups have a space that they can identify with. And so they're at a lot of organizations, there are groups that are just dedicated to women, or groups that are just dedicated to Hispanic, Latin, or Black identifying, right? So it really is dependent on the underrepresented population. But the goal is to, one, uplift, empower, but also provide the resources for advancement. Because we've seen historically there have been barriers, many barriers set up within organizations for these groups to excel. And that's what I was speaking to. It's disheartening when I don't see that the very people that are advocating and really trying to drive the change internally are the ones being laid off first, are the ones not advancing, are the ones still the only on their team. But when they get in their group, at least they have a few people that they can connect with. I think it's very unfair, and that has to shift.
Dara, why do you think we have these different silos of ethnic racial identities? Does it weaken their bargaining power in a way?
I've always gone back and forth with this, and I've always been torn. You know, in one of the organizations that I was working for, I was like, nah, let's remove these groups, right? Like we need all underrepresented people to come together. So
except
we can
for
fight
white
together
women.
For the greater.
Let's have a different pocket for that.
Oh, pop it. So fight together for the greater good. And then I switched it. And I was like, wait, hold on. Nope. We need these groups. We're all suffering in this moment, right? We need groups to lean on. What has me so torn is that because these groups function so silo, it's hard for me to see also sometimes the disconnect between, let's say, the Asian identifying group with the Black identifying group, or the Asian identifying group with the Hispanic Latin identifying group. And so you see this disconnect when really at the foundation, we have all experienced a deep level of barriers that exist for us. And I believe in the power of people and numbers. That's how movements have been created. So if we're not connected, even just within these ERG groups as a whole, then we'll always continue to see the disconnect because we're all fighting for our own thing. And so I'm torn because, you know, sometimes I'm like, I understand it. You just want to lean on your people sometimes where you don't get the questions.
But then coalition building doesn't happen, right? And I sometimes feel this is so intentional to keep these groups apart so that they aren't as strong. There is strength in numbers. Imagine if they were all to come together and fight for all of us, not just few pockets, right?
And that's what organizations are very fearful of, right? And that's why I kind of go back and forth, because I've always referred to them to some extent as segregated groups.
If we were to take DEI model within workforce and apply it to our society, what do you think we'll see?
If we took the DEI frameworks, I think what's interesting about DEI is there's not just one framework. It's not like the financial model that we know you have to apply in Excel and here's the outcome that you will get. I think we all as a society are still trying to figure that part out. The framework that I like to follow is the three Ps. It's people, it's practice, and then product. And if we apply that to the world, then we would start off with people. If we want to understand people, we have to understand, okay, what are the historical gaps that started off from the beginning of time that brings such great grand division that folks are not healed by just yet. It's like getting bit by a dog, a very deep wound, and it's like, oh, all right, we're going to just patch it up with a Band-Aid, but not getting the stitches.
And that's exactly what we've been doing for so long. That's what we've done, just patching it up.
There's a lot of pain. You know, there's a lot of like unleft pain. And so you hear people say, oh, well, that happened a long time ago. I didn't do that. Okay, you didn't physically do that, but you still benefited from it. And if you benefited from it, wouldn't you want to figure out, okay, well, how can I now pour back in? Or how can I seek to understand what happened so that does not we don't repeat that. And I think that's where the pain is coming from for a lot of people. It's, we're just brushing it off.
You're absolutely right. And I think one component that is often overlooked is accountability, right?
Mm-hmm.
Checking your privilege, checking where you are in this hierarchical structure, whether it's racial, socioeconomic. And I feel like a lot of times people are not intentionally thinking about their own privilege or checking their own privilege, right? Because it makes them uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of work to do. Lehra, what is your ultimate goal for DEI? If there was just one goal that you wanted to achieve?
One goal, this role is not needed because things are actually happening. That every single person within an organization understands how to drive inclusive actions because they've done the work before, no matter who they are. That's my goal. Someone asked the other day, she said, is the goal to almost like mitigate, or do we want to kind of exterminate, right?
That's a good point.
And will we ever even see that in our lifetime? And so I don't know if we'll see that in our lifetime, everything going away. But I think if we can start to chip away at it, mitigate and use technology for the greater good to make sure that these barriers are removed. I always say, like, if I could do this work without even saying that I'm doing the work, that's the goal. And that's what I'm trying to do with AeroDai.
In the end, Lehra, if you were to describe the United States of America in a word or a sentence through DEI lens, how would you do that?
It is complicated and contained with pain.
Oh my gosh. I'm just trying to sit with this thought for a minute. Thank you so much, Lehra. Where can people find your work and this incredible platform?
Thank you so much for the amplification. Folks can find me on LinkedIn, Lehra Jenkins. They can also head to AeroDai, so that's AeroDei.com. They can also follow AeroDai on LinkedIn. We have a pretty active page. And they can also read my book that was launched last year called The Inclusive Organization. And there's some history in there as to how this got started and a little bit about the Spanish Inquisition as well. So definitely read up.
Thank you so much, Lehra.
Thank you so much.
I hope you were able to learn something positive, something nice about DEI through this episode. It worries me to see that the political divide in this country runs so deep right now that we are unable to embrace, accept, acknowledge, recognize, celebrate humanity in others, others who do not look like us. And I can only hope that through these conversations, we can uplift our collective humanity. This episode was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by Bobak Afshari and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is amazing Hazik Ahmed Farid. Theme music for this podcast is done by Simon Hutchinson. Come back next week when I sit down with another unique guest to hear their story, their immigrant-related perspective. Take care.